Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Wormhole by Keith Brook and Eric Brown. Narrated by Eric Michael Summerer. 1. Cold Case. Kemp swiveled his recliner and stared through the narrow window of his office. Somewhere outside, he knew, the sun had come up over London. Snow had fallen during the night. On the rooftops, it would be crisp and white, but down here, in the shady alleyway to the rear of Homicide HQ, all was gray slush and windblown litter. As Kemp peered up at the sliver of dawn sky, he caught the glare of a suborb rising like a slow firework from the Thames estuary hub 50 kilometers away, heading east to China. Around Kemp, images of the dead shimmered in the unlighted office. He knew he owed it to these people, or rather to their loved ones and relatives, to turn his seat back to the console and engage with the database, but he was struck by a soul-sapping inertia that kept him staring through the window. His imp bleeped, and reluctantly, he turned and signaled to take the call. He expected it to be Danny, telling him to shift himself and join her in the car. Either her or Commander Song, with yet another case to add to the workload. It was neither. The image of an overweight man in a crumpled suit resolved itself over his desk. Edward Bryce. Kemp sat up. Ed, it's been months. A case had thrown Kemp and the lawyer together 5 years ago, and much to Kemp's surprise, the working liaison had developed into a friendship. They had a lot in common. They were both widowers, both in their late 50s, overweight and overworked, and they both liked dark, old-fashioned pubs where they could drink away their worries and gripe about their respective jobs.
I'm sorry, Bryce said, but Ma Holding died yesterday.
Kemp's automatic response was to glance immediately at the ghost image of Sophie Holding.
I knew she was ill. I saw her just before. She wanted to thank you for everything you've done.
Kemp swore.
That was fuck all, Ed.
Bryce shrugged.
You could say that, or you could say that you gave her hope. That was all she had to cling to.
I saw her before those meetings you had with her, and I saw her afterwards.
You were incredible. You gave her something to live for all the good it did. Nevertheless.
Kemp sighed.
I'm sorry, it's just...
He signaled, swung his hand around his head, and the images of the dead processed around the room and lined up behind him so that Bryce could see the gallery.
Look, Ed, 55 of them. They're from 9 years back to around 25 years ago. You know what they say on this job? The law of diminishing returns. The older a case is, the less chance there is of solving it. I worked my balls off on the Holding case and got nowhere. Dead end after dead end after.
Bryce nodded, conciliatory.
I know, Gordon. But, you know, you do tend to dwell on the cases that remain unsolved. Don't forget all the ones you do resolve. Every time you do that, you allow entire families to move on, and you're damned good at what you do.
When I crack the fuckers. He waved again, killed the images, all but one. He dragged it before him, so that the 3D portrait of the 18-year-old Afro-Caribbean girl hung between him and Bryce, smiling out at him. He gestured, and the image started to cycle through a short recording of the girl laughing and talking to camera. He didn't have to unmute her to hear the soft tones of her voice in his head.
Look at her, Bryce.
Kemp shook his head.
You went to Ma Holding's place. You saw all the pics she had of Sophie. They were her way of coping, of keeping her only daughter alive and with her. And she trusted me to find her killer. As I said, you gave her hope. And there are 54 others. And their families and loved ones who haven't been able to move on. You know something? Go on. Days like today, I feel like retiring.
Bryce smiled.
A little way to go yet, Gordon. Or requesting a transfer. Not that anywhere else would have me. Surely, with all your experience, you know me, Ed. I don't fit anywhere else. And I can't take authority. Too bolshy by half. Song's own words. Which wasn't the whole truth. Even Ed Bryce, who Kemp considered his best friend, didn't know why he'd been put out to pasture in the morgue after 20 years in homicide. "I called you about something else, other than Ma Holding," Bryce said. "More bad news? It's been a while since I had Martin look over your imp." Kemp didn't trust his superiors. He wouldn't have been surprised if Commander Song turned out to be a Chinese mole, and his mistrust extended to the content of his annual implant upgrades. He didn't like the idea that every year Song had his techs download who knew what into his running system. He'd once grumbled about this to Bryce over a beer, and the lawyer had said he knew just the man to run a few tests on Kemp's implant and ensure it was clean. Bryce knew a lot of people from every walk of life, and one of them was Martin Kalsa, a cyber wizard whose definition of legality was elastic. The upshot was that after every department upgrade, Martin scanned Kemp's implant for spyware and whatever other nasties Song's team might have planted. Now Kemp waved. "No need. Still running on the same program as last year. I'll be in touch when they call me in for an upgrade, okay?" "In the meantime," Bryce said, "let's meet. You look like you could use a drink." "I'm busy today, but maybe tomorrow." "Tomorrow it is, then." They chatted for another 5 minutes before Bryce was called away and cut the connection. Kemp reinstated the gallery of the dead, pushed it back to the darkened walls, and once again turned to stare out at what passed for a view. A month ago, he'd gone to see Ma Holding in her bedsit by Hackney Lakes to give her what he euphemistically called a progress report. He visited her every once in a while, like a dutiful son, although it became harder on each occasion. This time he'd even considered lying about a new lead, anything to stoke her hope, particularly when her health was clearly failing. She'd gripped his hand and stared at him with her massive, yellowing eyes.
"You'll find him for me, won't you, Gordon?"
He'd prized her fingers from his and promised that he'd find Sophie's killer if it were the last thing he did. He willed himself to turn the seat, access the database, and go through the Holding case yet again. He knew that for the next few days he'd be fired up until frustration at not getting anywhere overcame him and he took up the freshest case on file, leaving Sophie's murder unsolved and Ma Holding's hope to die with her. He looked up, seeing Danny in the doorway, leaning slantwise against the frame, and wondered how long she'd been there.
"You look, if you don't mind my saying, as if you've slept all night in that seat."
Her voice was home counties, primly correct. Anyone less like a DI he'd never met. She wore a dark trouser suit like a uniform, with its side-fastening tunic and high collar, and her jet hair was long and straight. She looked like a high-flying executive up for an interview with a pan-global consortium.
"My saying," he mocked.
She was 25 years his junior, and even though they shared the same rank, she was his superior in charge of this unit. When she was instated over him in the morgue, he'd come in for relentless flack from colleagues. Kemp had shrugged and told them, truthfully, that he couldn't give a damn. In fact, he was glad of the company. Aunt Danny Bellini turned out to be a decent kid who didn't rub his nose in the fact that she was a fast-tracked Cambridge graduate and he an ill-educated slob who'd risen, slowly, through the ranks. "But no, I haven't been here all night. No more than an hour. Oh, I just had a call from Bryce. Ma Holding passed away yesterday."
"I heard."
She entered the room, picked her way round discarded curry cartons and beer bulbs biodegrading on the floor, and sat down. "So I'm setting a couple of things aside and going through the files again," he said. She stared at him through the shadows, then shook her head.
"Not today, Gordon."
"What?"
"I've just seen Song. You're not going to like this."
"Like what?" She gestured around the office at the 55 dead people staring at them.
"Song has just ordered us to put everything aside for a while."
"Everything? You're joking."
"He wants us to look into something else. Priority. A single case. We've to give it our full attention.
Kemp grunted. Fuck him.
That's what I nearly said.
Kemp smiled at that. For all her middle-class primness, Danny could swear with the best of them.
So what's this case? Must be important.
He had to admit, if only to himself, that his curiosity had been piqued.
It is. A top research scientist, working at the cutting edge of suspension technology, well-connected, a very high-profile case.
Why haven't I heard of this before now? And since when has suspension technology been cutting edge? She combed a long strand of dark hair from her cheek and smiled at him.
Because this cold case is really cold, she said. The victim was Sebastian White, and he was murdered 80 years ago.
Kemp blinked, processing her words. That's not a cold case, Danny. That's an archaeological dig.
I said something not dissimilar to Song.
If we can't find Sophie's killer, and that happened 15 years ago, then how the hell can we be expected to solve a case 80 years old? He shook his head. This doesn't make sense. The killer will be dead. Any witnesses, likewise. I mean, what the hell does it even matter after so long?
I know. She bit her lip. There's something strange going on. Song was insistent. He wants us to devote everything to this. The odd thing is, he couldn't or wouldn't tell me who authorized the case.
It's come down a long way.
From the very top, she said.
His first reaction was one of anger. Anger that a pen pusher like Song had ordered them to set aside more than 50 ongoing cases. Then he considered what Danny had told him, and his anger tempered into curiosity again.
I'm intrigued. Look, I'll just grab a tea and we'll access the file. I squirted it to your desk as soon as I left Song, Danny said. But let's go up to mine.
She looked around the mess of his room. They took the elevator to Danny's spacious office 4 floors up, with a view of snowbound London on 2 sides. She made him a mug of English breakfast tea while he accessed the file and brought a still image of the murder victim into the air before him. They sat side by side, sipping tea, and Danny talked him through the case.
Sebastian White, she said, indicating the floating image. A British Euro national, 54. He and his wife were two of the continent's leading scientists in the field of suspended animation.
The pics showed a thin-faced, hawk-nosed, balding man with a severe expression.
He graduated from Oxford in 2075, Danny said. Spent 10 years at MIT in the States, then was lured back by the European Space Organization, who offered him a fabulous salary and a lab staffed by the best scientists and technicians from across Europe. For the last 24 years of his life, he worked in the ESO labs in Geneva.
The name's familiar, he said. Wasn't he related to Randolph White? Danny nodded. She moved a hand over the virtual keyboard, and a second pix shimmered into life beside the first. This one showed a familiar head-and-shoulders image of Randolph White, the patrician statesman and the founding father of the United States of Europe. He was thin-faced and aquiline, with distinguished graying hair and smiling eyes.
Randolph White was 60 when his younger brother was murdered, and he took it badly, by all accounts. They were close. Randolph retired from public life soon after. Some said he spiraled into depression after the murder. He died 5 years later, in 2114.
She waved a hand again, and the image of Randolph vanished, to be replaced with a dozen scene-of-crime pics. Kemp frowned. These all we've got?
It's all Song came up with. He assumes interactives were shot, but if so, they were lost.
Lost?
This was 80 years ago, Gordon. Officially, the case was closed 5 years later.
What about interactives with the suspects?
Song has requested them from Geneva, she said.
Kemp studied the scene of crime pics. 20 years in homicide had accustomed him to grisly images. By comparison with some, though, these were tame. There was a lot of blood, but the victim had suffered just a single stab wound. Half a dozen images showed Sebastian White from different angles. He was lying on his back in a big, pristine kitchen, sunlight illuminating a face as pale as his old-fashioned white suit.
The hilt of a knife emerged from the center of his chest, and the front of his suit was stained red.
He died within seconds. Forensics have drawn up a profile of the killer. They think the culprit was taller than the victim, weighing between 70 and 90 kilos, either a man or a woman.
Kemp grunted. That narrows it down. DNA? Danny shook her head.
None.
What?
Not a trace.
So it was a pro. An assassin. No one else could have got away without leaving some biological trace.
Or it was someone with sufficient scientific know-how to be able to wipe the place clean.
What about motive?
None apparent. He was, by all accounts, happily married to a fellow scientist, was well-liked, and had plenty of friends. There was a rumor at the time that it might have been the Russians attempting to slow down ESO's Mu-Ori program. But if that was so, they left it late in the day. I think we can discard that line of inquiry.
A government-backed assassin certainly fit the profile of someone who could cover their tracks so well, but Kemp knew the security services would have been all over that angle at the time and had clearly come up with nothing. Danny waved again. The scene of crime images shrank to the periphery, and the pics of a vast, bulky starship hovered above the desk.
The Strasbourg.
You know what happened? My father was obsessed, Kemp said. He followed the mission when he was a kid, and while I was growing up, he watched the Hollows obsessively. It must have been a hell of a shock to those who'd lived through the mission at the time.
You can say that again. The hope of Europe, if not the world, rested on the success of the Strasbourg.
90 years ago, ESO had discovered an Earth-like planet orbiting the star Mu-Ori, 50 light-years from Earth. Traveling at top speed, a ship would take almost 80 years to reach the planet, which pretty much ruled out a crewed expedition, until ESO announced a breakthrough in their research into suspended animation. In 2110, the mission to Mu-Ori 2 lighted out from the Earth orbital station with 96 technicians, scientists, and assorted specialists aboard, all in suspended animation for the duration of the trip. Danny stared at the image of the ship.
Hard to believe that they'd have arrived by now. This very year, in fact, if not for the blowout.
Seeing the spark in her eyes, Kemp was surprised. He'd never had her down as a space geek. She waved, and the stilled image of the Strasbourg came to life, moving across a dusted starscape with stately grace. This was a computer-generated mock-up, of course, put together from facts gleaned from the telemetry that had reached Earth 4 months into the mission. A tiny bloom of flame showed 3/4 of the way down the colossal length of the Strasbourg, causing multiple internal explosions and a catastrophic rupture to the spine of the starship. With agonizing slowness, over the course of 10 long minutes, the ship broke up with the loss of all 96 scientists and technicians. Danny said,
Sebastian White was one of the top scientists working on the suspended animation technology used aboard the Strasbourg.
She wiped the starship from above her desk and reinstated the scene of crime pics, staring at the image of the dead man.
For a time after White's murder, suspicion focused on 3 people.
And these were? Danny waved, and 3 mugshots shimmered into life above the desk.
Lee Chan-Wu, White's deputy in the suspension lab at ESO. Motive? He wanted White's job.
All very well, but Chan-Wu was at a conference in Paris at the time of the killing, with a comprehensive digital footprint and about 100 witnesses.
Then there was Ed Malroux, White's business partner. White had his fingers in a number of financial pies across the state, and not all of them were going well. Some sources suggest that there were differences of opinion between the 2 men, leading to an argument.
And I suppose Malroux had a cast-iron alibi, too? She nodded.
He was in a business meeting with his financial advisor in Lucerne on the morning of White's death, all of which was confirmed by telemetry and digital mapping.
They could always have hired a pro to do the job, of course, he pointed out.
Who's the woman?
The 3rd pics showed the smiling image of a dark-haired, dark-skinned woman in her mid-30s, attractive in a wide-jawed, broad-shouldered, athletic kind of way.
Rima Cognac, Sebastian White's wife.
Parisian and a top researcher in the same field as her husband. They met working for ESO on the Mu'ori project. According to White's personal assistant, she'd been overheard arguing with her husband the day before the murder.
But I take it that she had an alibi, too?
She was in a one-to-one meeting with a Captain Xavier Fernandez, 5 kilometers away at the time of the murder. The digital trace isn't so comprehensive in Cognac's case. She'd turned her comms off, but Fernandez was regarded as a solid witness.
Kemp frowned. Now why is that name familiar?
He was the captain of the Strasbourg, Danny said.
Why was Cognac meeting him?
Rima Cognac was heading the suspension team aboard the Strasbourg, Danny said. 6 days after her husband was killed, she left Earth for Mu'ori on the ill-fated ship.
Kemp looked at her. That sounds suspiciously convenient, not to mention cold-hearted, for her to leave at such a time.
Danny shrugged. I'm not sure. She'd been training for the mission for years, remember, and we don't know how close she was to her husband.
He stared at the image of the smiling woman. And 4 months after embarking on the mission, she died in the blowout.
Not that she would have suffered in the accident, she said. The experts say that everyone aboard the ship perished instantly.
Kemp grunted. It's to be hoped they're right.
Such a tragic case in many ways, Danny said, staring at Cognac. I don't know, but she seems so confident and optimistic there. She was at the top of her profession, about to travel to another star. Then her husband is butchered and the Strasbourg explodes. Christ, no one knows what lies in wait.
Either that or she was a stone-cold murderer, Kemp pointed out.
Cheer up! All this is long gone. Yes, but doesn't that make it all the more poignant? If the Strasbourg hadn't blown up, Cognac would be alive and about to step onto the soil of another world.
You love all this stuff, don't you, Danny? Starships and alien worlds. You're a real space geek. She raised her cup to her mouth, hiding her smile.
Those movies were everywhere when I was growing up, she said. Isn't it every child's dream to see new worlds?
He shrugged. So, where the hell do we start with this? The investigator's initial reports, I suppose. She shook her head.
We start by interviewing someone who was around at the time.
He stared at her. You're kidding. This was 80 years ago.
You've heard of Sir Alistair Fairlie White?
Wasn't he a politician?
A Tory cabinet minister. He was Sebastian White's son from his first marriage.
He must be a hell of an age by now.
He's 112 and has just undergone his third rejuvenation treatment. According to Song, the process failed spectacularly. An abortive telomerase snip disrupted neural functioning and dislodged some old memories.
So this was why the case was reopened?
That's a possibility. I'm not exactly looking forward to this. Song asked how strong my stomach was.
Kemp raised an eyebrow.
Apparently, the man's little more than a cadaver. He's resident at some exclusive private hospital in Berkshire.
Great, he said. Are we taking your car? Mine's...
I've seen your car, she said. It's not much better than your office.
Kemp smiled awkwardly. Not much better than his office was putting it kindly. 2. Chromosomal dysfunction. It took over an hour to motor through the 50 kilometers of urban sprawl from central London to rural Berkshire. But at least Danny's Zhongguah was both spacious and immaculately clean. They passed the ruins of the old suborbital station at Ealing, bombed by nationalist terrorists 50 years ago, and left in situ, a surreal arrangement of twisted metal and blackened buildings, as an epitaph to the 3,000 citizens killed in the attack. Around it, and on either side of the road leading out of London, gleaming state-of-the-art domes and minarets testified to massive Chinese investment. Kemp was old enough to accept the takeover as the inevitable consequence of a failing economy devoured by the expansionist tide of Cathay imperialism, though he recalled his father's animosity to all things Oriental. He died a bitter man,
spouting the xenophobic tirades of his Tory heroes. His father would have given his right arm to have met Sir Alastair Fairley White, though perhaps not in his current physical condition. As the car eased itself from the slipway, the onboard narrated their route, interspersed with ads and a stream of mindless Shanghai popsack. The car slid between greenery dripping with deliquescing snow, wintry sunlight reflected in puddles on the tarmac ahead. Kemp found it oddly unsettling to be out of London. He laughed.
What? I just realized this must be the first time I've been out of the city in almost 5 years.
She stared at him.
Are you sure?
I think so. Can you recall a case that wasn't in London?
Okay, but you must have left the city at some point. Life isn't all about work.
Why would I? I don't know anyone who lives outside the capital.
What about holidays?
You know I can't stand them. I'd rather spend my free time online. She stared at him.
For someone who reads all that history stuff.
Says the space geek. Go on.
You have a very limited... How shall I put this?
Knowledge? I know nothing, is what you mean. Well, I know a lot about life in the 20th and 21st century, before the takeover. She murmured.
For all the good that does you.
We all have our interests. You're obsessed with spaceflight. He couldn't resist adding, for all the good that does you.
Touché.
He looked at her, surprised by her capitulation. Usually she would have argued with him, and won. There was something about her today. She seemed distant, distracted. He changed the subject. Anyway, what do you know about Sir Alastair Fairley White, other than the fact that he was a conservative cabinet minister back before you were born? He glanced at the windscreen readout, which told them they were 5 kilometers from their destination.
He was on the far right of the party, Danny said. Anti-Europe and virulently anti-Chinese.
A little Englander, in other words. He thought back to the bombed-out ruins they had passed in Ealing, relic of a bitterly nationalistic period. She frowned.
I haven't heard that expression.
Ah, you should read more history, he said. It's a mid-20th term to denote a prevalent political insularity amongst those of the right at the time.
His pro-British stance put him out of step with his uncle, Randolph White. They had little time for each other, and Alastair ploughed a lone political furrow.
What were the politics of his father, Sebastian?
Sebastian and his brother Randolph were both pro-European unionists.
The car took a turning off the main road and decreased speed along a leafy lane between vast fields of gnarled grapevines. How old was Alistair when his father was murdered? Hold on, you said he's 112 now, and Sebastian was killed 80 years ago. 32, right? Danny laughed.
My God, Gordon, you're a mathematician, too.
Kemp tipped an imaginary hat. I wonder what memories the rejuve process has dislodged. Do you know where he was when his father was murdered?
According to the investigators' reports, he was a junior minister at the time, attending a committee meeting in Westminster.
Probably trying his best to scupper the Chinese buyout of Birmingham. That was around that time, wasn't it?
Pass.
80 years ago, Kemp said. Join the cold case team and visit the past. The onboard caroled,
We approach our destination. Please prepare for arrival.
Kemp straightened in his seat as they progressed along a lane between ancient oak trees. In the distance, standing on a slight rise, was the 4-square Georgian monolith of Carstairs Hall. They came to a perimeter wall, and the car slowed to a halt before an iron gate. Danny touched her wrist comm and murmured her name. The gates swung slowly open, and the car eased up a graveled drive towards the house. They were met on a grand sweep of steps of the hall by a tall young man in an impeccably cut black suit who introduced himself as Peter Conway, the business manager at Carstairs Hall.
Commander Song informed me you were on your way, if you'd care to follow me.
He led them into a vast marble hallway, then gestured along a corridor. Despite the manor house exterior of the hall, its interior was decorated in generic chinoiserie style. Geometrical wooden furniture, folding screens decorated with red and gold brushstroke dragons.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?